Hello?
Why don't you want to talk to me?
Well, I'm getting ready to watch a video.
Really? What?
Oh, just some scary movie.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Halloween. No, the one with the guy in the white mask who walks around and stalks babysitters.
Yeah, so you got a boyfriend?
Why? You want to ask me out on a date?
Maybe. You never told me your name.
Why do you want to know my name?
I want to know who I'm looking at.
What did you say?
Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Tiana.
And this is Next Door Villain,
a podcast where we uncover the villains to discover their humanity. Okay, Joe.
Yes.
I have a series of questions to ask you.
Oh, okay.
Number one, are you a virgin?
No.
Number two, do you do drugs or drink?
I'm drinking literally right now.
Have you ever said to someone, be right back?
Pretty regularly, yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry to say, but you would die in a horror movie.
Those are the rules.
Those are the rules. Okay, let's do the other start. I didn't actually
Okay. Like
this one's better, right. Actually.
Hello, Joe. What are you doing right now?
I'm recording a podcast.
Are you wearing a blue-green shirt?
Yeah, it's blue.
I can see you because I'm there, actually.
Not because of the FaceTime video screen?
No. What is your favorite horror movie?
I want to say maybe Nightmare on Elm Street, or The Thing, or Scream.
Great. Now I'm going to ask you another question, and if you don't get this right, I'm going to kill you, because remember, I can see you.
Okay.
I'm not a very good horror movie villain. All right, but this is serious, okay? What was the name of the villain in Child's Play?
Not a clue. Never seen it.
You know, like the doll? I'm going to give you a hint, okay? Because I really don't want to kill you. You know, like the doll with the orange hair? Like,
yeah, what about him?
Do you know his name? You don't want to die? You have a computer right in front of you. You could Google it.
I could, but I'm not sure you're actually going to kill me. I kind of want to find out what you're going to do if you have to kill me.
I will stab you in the back and slit your throat and throw your head out the window into your garden that you worked so hard on.
What if I actually got murdered right now on camera?
You know what? I've actually thought about that before.
That would be like the most Scream thing ever. If we're here talking about Scream and then Ghostface showed up and killed me on camera.
That would be not cool. But I've thought about before what it would be like if one of us had an emergency, but we're in different states and totally different locations. Like, do I call 911 and say that someone in Maine is having an emergency? Like, does that work?
I'm not sure, because I think 911 calls to, like, the nearest local call center.
My gosh, we need to put together an emergency plan. Well, or maybe not, because I'm a horror movie villain and I'm going to kill you, so don't do that. Anywho, yeah, I think, yeah, you're going to die because you have never seen Chucky.
Did you say Chunky?
Chucky. Yeah, that's the doll that's like.
Yeah. Did you say Chunky?
No, Chucky. Not Chunky. Chucky.
Yes, Chucky.
Chucky. And then there's the bride of Chucky. She wears like a bride dress and she marries Chucky and she's like.
I've never seen these movies.
Oh, okay.
Well, if you're listening, if you're still listening, if you're still listening to the podcast at this point, you may have surmised that we are talking about one of my favorite horror films, Scream, released in 1996, directed by Wes Craven, an icon in the horror community. He did Nightmare on Elm Street and other films.
I didn't know he directed Elm Street.
Yes. Yeah. So he really, like, multiple times kind of revolutionized horror films. And Scream was definitely that case where horror films really had a moment in like the 70s and the early 80s, but then they sort of kind of got redundant, these slasher films, and they were just making sequels upon sequels of them. From the research, like just reading about Scream and stuff, it seems like it was at a time when people were kind of sick of that stuff. And so Scream was kind of this new, it was a new take on horror films that was kind of fresh and exciting and fun, but also scary. And it was about these teenagers who like are aware of all of the stupid horror tropes, yet they're still like dying from them.
It definitely makes you wonder, like, because you know all of these horror tropes, do they actually help you in surviving if you were in that situation?
Yeah, according to the Scream movies, no. Being aware of horror didn't seem to help very many people. And the one character, the main character, Sydney Prescott, was the one who didn't really care for horror movies, and she's the one who ultimately survives. And speaking of the fact that Sydney survives, there's going to be some major spoilers in this episode. Scream, aside from being a great horror movie, is also a great whodunit, where you don't really know who's committing the murders throughout the film, and they make it seem like different times, different people from this group could be the murderer. And at least for me, when I originally watched this years ago and when I rewatched it just a couple weeks ago, I still was surprised in the end who did it.
Yeah, me too. But then once they revealed themselves, then it made more sense, because those two boys were like, or at least one of them was super insensitive to Sydney's trauma that she was feeling. And then I caught this too in the beginning, or right after Drew Barrymore dies, Stu says something like, "There was a liver in the mailbox." And I was like, is that true? But then I was like, maybe there was a liver in the mailbox and no one reported on it, but he knew and he just put it there. He was just like, bloop, bloop, mailbox.
Yeah.
Ready for delivery.
Yeah. Rewatching the film, like when you look back on the movie, it's like, oh, obviously it was those guys. And even as I was watching it, I was like, oh, it's Billy, or oh, it's Stu. But then they would give you some little bit of information that was so compelling that someone else did it. They were like, oh, it must not be those guys. Those guys are too obvious. It must be this guy.
Right.
So it's a really engaging film. One of my favorite horror films of all time. And I just saw the new movie, which would be Scream 5, which is a requel, which is a prequel. No, it's a reboot that's also a sequel.
Hmm.
And I'm not going to reveal any plot points of it. If you're listening, I highly recommend it. Not quite as good as the original Scream, but still lots of fun, still very self-referential, still very like aware of horror movies and what's going on in the world of horror. It was a fun romp.
So for this episode, we're just going to focus on the 1996 film, the first Scream.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Scream 2, 3, and 4 do add a lot of information that sort of helps explain some of the things that happened in Scream 1, but for the most part, we're going to ignore those and just focus on the first film. And largely we're doing that because Ghostface changes every film. And so we didn't want to talk about every single different Ghostface, but we're really focusing on Billy and Stu from the first film and trying to empathize with them, which I anticipate is going to be a real challenge.
We'll just try and see how it goes. Should we do the 30-second summary?
Yes, we should do the 30-second summary. It's the part of the episode where we do our best to describe the entire plot of the story or the entirety of the character in just 30 seconds with no preparation. And if you like, you can go onto Spotify and vote for who you think did a better job. We try to put some little bit of stakes to it. So Tiana, what do you think? Oh, I got it.
You got it? Okay, because I don't got
it. All right. So whoever loses the 30-second intro challenge has to prank call someone.
No. Can it be someone that we know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
Okay. I feel like that's better so that I don't get sued. Do we get to decide who we call?
Yes. Yeah. You can prank call someone and do a movie quiz like Ghostface does for Drew Barrymore in the beginning of Scream and film it for Instagram or TikTok or whatever.
All right, deal. I would shake your hand, but as we discussed earlier, I'm not actually in Maine. Or maybe I am.
Maybe. Probably not.
Maybe I'm right behind you. I made you look, though.
All right. 3, 2, 1, go.
All right. So Billy was dating Sydney, and he does some really weird fishy stuff throughout the movie. Like, he kind of pressures her to have sex and ish, kind of. And he's a little kind of creepy guy. And he has kind of those, that jaw that just makes him look kind of mysterious. And we find out that he's Ghostface, and he's killed a bunch of people, and so did Stu. And at the end, they died because Sydney killed them.
Time's up. All right. Okay. That was an explanation.
Okay. All right. 3, 2, 1, go.
All right. Scream is the story of two murderers, Billy and Stu. And Billy became a murderer because his parents divorced, and he wanted to murder the woman who slept with his dad and caused their parents to divorce. And yeah, it's a pretty thin background for why someone becomes a serial killer, but it's what happened, and he recruited this other dude, Stu, to help him commit a bunch of murders.
That was good.
thank you.
I mean, we'll get into this maybe later too, but Billy's motivation is so dumb.
I say it's one of the worst and best parts of the film is how much they create these motivations for all these different people in the film. And then the actual motivation for the killings is pretty weak. So background for the film, Sydney Prescott, who is the primary character, her mother was involved in the reason all of this is happening, sort of. So she, I guess, was cheating on Sydney's father. And one of the guys that she was cheating on him with was Billy's dad. And when Billy's mom found out, they divorced. And that is what upset Billy. And then there's this whole other sort of plot point with her mom. And well, actually, it's not really another plot point because it's caused by Billy. Mm-hmm. So Billy, after his parents divorce, is upset and basically murders Sydney's mom, Maureen, and frames it on this other guy who goes to jail because of it.
And death row.
Holy crap. Mm-hmm. Wow. I forgot about that. But that's instead. I'm against capital punishment.
Me too. Just putting that on
the
record.
The kind of podcast we are.
Yeah.
And now, a year later, they've started a killing spree. Well, Billy, I guess, has started a killing spree again. And do you know why he started killing again? Was there like a clear motivation for like why he got back at
it? No. He said that he doesn't believe in motives. So, no.
That's right. And he has recruited his buddy Stu as a co-conspirator, a co-murderer.
Stu.
And they seem to just be killing anybody that even has the smallest qualm. Like, they kill the principal of the high school, Henry Winkler. I guess probably just because they don't like the principal of the school.
Or maybe it just happened to be there.
Yeah. So, great. Hopefully that's clear now.
And Stu's motivation was peer pressure.
Yes. So he says. But we'll get into that. One of the things about this film and all of the Scream films is that they're incredibly self-referential and like aware of horror movies tropes, and the kids are so like smart in an almost pretentious way at times. And the plots are a little bit convoluted as far as like what's going on. So it is a little bit difficult to explain. Hopefully, if you're listening this far, you've seen the films. And I hope you haven't gotten this far into the podcast without watching the film, because we've really wrecked it for you.
There were a few quotes that I liked from the movie, just three. It's the millennium. Motives are incidental. Movies make psychos more creative. And the third one that really made me laugh was, you don't look a day over 12. Because the newscaster, Courtney Cox, when she was flirting with the cop, she was like...
Dewey.
Oh, yeah, Dewey. She was like flattering him. She was like, wow, you look so young. You don't look a day over 12. And I was like, 12? What are you talking about? I don't know. Anywho, her character was weird.
Yeah, I mean, she was making a joke. She was... belittling him was what she was doing.
Oh.
She didn't actually think he was
12. Oh, I didn't catch that.
She was just being a jerk.
Ooh. Oh, okay. But he didn't catch that either, so I guess I have the intelligence equivalent to Dewey.
He was a doopy, like cute artist.
Very relatable.
Yeah.
This movie did teach me something, that if you're being chased in your house, like by a killer, you should go outside.
Go to public. Get out of private spaces. Just run. Yeah. It's so frustrating that they don't do that.
Yeah. But what's funny is I don't know if I would have really known that. Maybe in the moment I'm like, oh, I need to go.
Well, I think we have this like innate desire to like surround ourselves by something. You know that feeling?
Yeah.
I live in a house by myself. Ooh, should I announce that publicly on a podcast while we're talking about murder?
Remember, I'm behind you.
And when I'm scared at night, which happens, I would say often, I'm scared of the dark. My house makes a lot of noises. My instinct is to like go under my blanket and hide, which right. is, when you really think about it, totally counterproductive. If a murderer were to walk into my room, I'm now like, I've restrained myself already. So I guess I do get that instinct to like hide in a confined space. Something about having the walls around you feel safe. When in reality, the open space would be better because at least you could run.
Yeah.
Now,
anywho.
Yeah, we're pretty far in and we have done zero empathizing with the villains. And I just want to say before I start empathizing with these villains publicly, I just want to reiterate that what we do on this podcast is we practice empathy like it's a muscle for us to exercise so that when we go out into the real world and meet real people who are hopefully not murderers, but might just be a little different than us, that it will be easier for us to empathize and relate and interact with them. But who we are talking about on this podcast are very fictional characters. And the fact that we are empathizing with them in no way justifies any sort of thing that they do. And these two killers today who brutally stab and murder and slice people open, like there is nothing that could ever justify those actions. But that doesn't mean that we can't get in their heads a little bit and try to think about why they're doing it. And understanding why they're doing it doesn't mean that we agree that what they're doing is right. It simply means that we understand. And sometimes, you know, I think we think of empathy as like, if we empathize with someone, then we understand them and like, we're not going to be mad at them or anything, or we're not going to hold them accountable. But just the opposite, empathy can be a tool that we use to understand someone so that we can act against them, so that we can figure out what they did, how they did it, so that perhaps we can lock them away or get them some sort of help or support. And in this case, like, in most cases, help and support, like being able to recognize that someone is in crisis and acting out because of it, that getting them help and support would be the best solution. I realize I'm on kind of my, what do they call it when you like...
pedestal?
Yeah. Oh, I realize I've kind of gotten on a little pedestal here, but I think it's important to say, and we used to say it a lot, and I got away from it. because I thought it was obvious, and I've gotten some criticism for being too empathetic towards villains. So I just want to be clear, because these two characters today, it's really hard to empathize with them, but I'm going to give it a go.
Yeah, we'll just try it. It ain't going to be perfect, but at least we'll just try it out.
Yeah. So Tiana, how do you empathize with them?
Well, first, very basic. I appreciate they don't try too hard. They just relax. They just call someone up on the phone, run around with a knife, kill them, done. No theatrics.
Yeah, I mean, a little theatrics. They are wearing a costume.
A little theatrics, but I appreciate the simplicity and the style that they're going with.
The costume can fit in a bag. They could carry it around with them. They can pop it on and off. It's very versatile.
So convenient.
It's something anybody could get, which made it hard to identify them because you could literally find that costume anywhere. Another like sort of outfit related thing that I found like a little bit endearing and relatable about Ghostface, and this is mm-hmm. true not just in the original Scream, but in pretty much all of them, there's something like a little bit goofy about the way that they move in that costume. And when they're like yeah. running around and when they're stabbing and stuff, that's like, it's a little awkward.
Yeah.
There's something in me that kind of feels for them a little bit. trying to do these, they're like so earnestly trying to stab someone to death, but they're just like kind of goofily falling over and like trying to get their limbs in the right direction.
Yeah. And they were hiding in the bathroom at one point in time, like they were standing on a toilet. And I wonder how long they were in the bathroom for. Well, like they probably just stood on that toilet awkwardly for like an hour or so, like people going in, taking a pee.
Just waiting for Sydney to have to use the bathroom.
Right. They're like, man, I hope she drank a lot of water. Or, man, I hope that Qdoba got to her stomach so that she can run into the bathroom and we can get her.
I hope she didn't use the bathroom on the other side of the school.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's a lot of hard work.
And then he also, when he jumps down from the toilet, he like has to adjust his outfit. Yeah. Did you notice that?
And that's when I realized that at least I knew that Ghostface was male because he had like some pretty big feet there. Not saying women can't have big feet, but you know what I mean. I was like, those look like big feet work boots. I do want to talk about motivation. I'm itching. Yeah.
Talk about it. We've touched on it a little bit, but at its very like basic core level, the motivation is for Billy that Sydney's mom caused his parents to divorce. That's like where it starts.
But
we're gonna dive deeper.
Yes. Can I?
Yeah. So you okay? You go yes. first. Yeah.
Okay. That motivation is pretty weak, and I don't think that is his main motivation. I don't think his main motivation exists. Because first, he's already killed Sydney's mom back when he supposedly had that motivation. And he's killing other people who also have nothing to do with Sydney's mom. So I just feel like that's not really his motivation anymore.
It might have triggered something in him to start killing someone. Right. But yeah, it's like a whole year later now.
It's a whole year later. And he also says, you know, during the ending scenes that he doesn't believe in motivations. He says that quote like, oh, Sydney wants some motivation, a why, but I don't have that for you. So I feel like his motivation doesn't really exist. I also find that very freeing. It makes things simpler. It carries on with this philosophy that like, does there have to be a why for everything?
My anxiety says yes.
But here, okay, let me explain further. Because yeah, does there have to be a reason for everything? Do you even have to rack your brain over it every single time? And a lot of like self-help books and like motivational success gurus, they talk a lot about how you have to have like a why to success, like why you want that goal, why do you want to do that thing? It keeps you on track and it keeps you motivated. And I can see how that's important. But I feel like Billy's philosophy is a good reminder that going too far or obsessing over the why could hold you back from just doing it.
Yeah, it could hold you back from serial murder.
Right. Well, just doing anything. You know, like I remember sitting in my organization's office during work, and we would have several meetings about our mission and values and our goals. Like several meetings, right? And a lot of American like companies and organizations really, really like that. They like that why. And I think a part of it has to do with like upper administration and the public like to see floofy mission and goals and values attached to an organization so that they can see their value. Mm-hmm. But then there was so much time that we could have spent just doing actions that aligned with that why. Maybe even doing it first is needed in order for you to figure out your motivation sometimes. So, like you can write all day about your why, but I don't know, it might just be freeing to just do it. Just try it out. Yeah, see if it works.
You're inspired by his lack of restraint in just letting go of his inhibitions and killing whoever he wants. Whenever
I guess so. I guess I could just take his philosophy a little bit and apply it to my own life. a tad, right? Yeah. Like, if I just keep thinking my why, like, I don't know, just do it and you'll find out your why. Or just do it and you'll get it done. Yeah. You'll be efficient.
Yeah, I was mocking you a little bit, but this is one of the number one things that I talk about with my therapist every week is like, why do I need to have a reason for everything that I do? Like, I can just do things. So yeah, I get your point that we don't agree with the fact that the thing that he's doing is murder,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that he seems to be doing it without needing a motivating force is emotionally inspiring.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of freeing. You know, it makes you think that sometimes things can't always be planned. Sometimes things can't always be thought out. Sometimes things need to be, but if you're racking your brain about what to do, I don't know, just try it out and do it. Be like Billy.
Yeah. Yeah. I took a more literal approach to his motivation. I went with what the film puts out there, which is that his parents split up because of Sydney's mother. And I sort of took that at face value. If you follow the Scream sequels, you learn that later on, Billy was motivated by another person who had even more of a stake, who basically, I guess, sort of groomed Billy into a murderer. And then Billy, in turn, groomed Stu. But we're focusing mainly on what we know from Scream 1 here, so I'm not going to dive into that. I just don't want you super fans out there to get mad at us for not recognizing that.
Yeah, yeah. And I've only seen Scream 1, so I'm just kind of basing my point off of that.
Yeah. I guess my feeling is that maybe that was his motivation, but if it was, it really, I think, indicates to us that Billy was not in a good place before
mm-hmm.
his parents' divorce.
Yeah.
That whatever was going on in his life, it wasn't great. And then his parents splitting up really set him off for some reason. We probably will never know what that reason is or what his life was like, but something was almost certainly going on. And I mean, this is, I feel like what we figure out every episode of this podcast is that most people who do bad things,
mm-hmm.
like it probably could have been prevented if they had had some sort of support system early on.
I don't know, though, because I feel like Billy has reached this, has overcrossed this like psychotic line to the point where I don't know if his, I don't know if he could be quote unquote fixed, or I don't know if what is going on in his brain could have been prevented if his brain was going to convince him to kill people eventually.
Yeah. And I agree with you that the divorce of his parents is kind of a weak motivation for him to go on this killing spree. If I'm really speculating, my suspicion is that it was sort of a snapping point for him. And when he committed the first murder, Sydney's mom, Maureen, that he got a taste for something. Because he was in a rough place, he let overwhelm him and then just kind of let that run rampant. So that's Billy. It's really hard to empathize with his actual actions. I you really can't justify anything that he's done. I mean, this is just straight up bad. We haven't even mentioned the fact that his relationship with Sydney, which they've been dating for nearly a year at this point, and he's kind of made out to be like more or less kind of this good boyfriend who is okay with the fact that they're not having sex for as long as they've been together, and he's not that pushy about it. But in hindsight, we kind of know that this whole relationship, this year of the relationship, is him being fake and developing this relationship with Sydney, which almost then it becomes this alibi, his closeness with Sydney, to make him not seem like the murderer.
Yeah. And he does get a little bit pushy about the sex thing, like when they're in the hallway, or he says some comments.
He does. But I felt it was striking, particularly in horror movies at this time period, like when they did finally have sex, that he did ask a couple of times to be sure that she mm-hmm. like was really okay with it. That felt and probably felt revolutionary at the time, or that would even be in the conversation, because horror movies, and there's whole areas of study about this, in a lot of ways are about sex and penetration. I wish I could cite the articles, because I read so much, and the way that like stabbing is this like sort of metaphorical representation of penetration, and it's a very like male...
like aggression?
Like symbolism of male aggression and, yeah. and sexuality. I don't know. There's this whole like realm of horror film psychology and research that I would love to get into more. But I'm also like a big scaredy cat, so I can't watch that many films.
Right.
I have to sparse them out. Anyway, so that's Billy. Do we need to talk about Billy anymore?
I really like his jawline.
He's cute, I think.
Like, I was like, whoa, those are some good cheeks, like on his face.
When I rewatched it, I was like, oh, is Johnny Depp in this? Did I forget that Johnny Depp is in this film? But it's not. He just looks a lot like Johnny right. Depp.
No, I think we covered Billy pretty well.
Yeah, which leads us to
Stu.
Possibly the more interesting character, Stu.
Yeah, Stu is funny. Or I laughed a lot, like, towards the end when Sydney asked him, like, why are you doing all of this? Why are you killing people? And he was like, peer pressure. Just.
And didn't she say, she was like, you think that's going to hold up?
Right. Yeah, probably not.
And I was like, yeah, that's not going to hold up at all.
I mean, hey, but if you get a good enough lawyer, who knows?
I listen to a lot of true crime and whatnot, and I did a little reading prior to this, because I think there is a big question of why is Stu involved at all?
Yeah.
He has no skin in this game, but like murder duos is kind of a thing, and there's a whole like line of research around it, and typically when people murder in teams, there's like a dominant person and a subservient person. Mm-hmm. And the dominant person is the one who really kind of preys upon that weaker person, finds someone to like pull into their orbit. And I got a quote here from a Psychology Today article called Partners in Crime, which explains this relationship. And it says, both parties need something critical from the other. The dominant person needs the follower's total loyalty in order to validate him or herself. And the subservient follower needs the power and authority of the dominant person. So he or she attempts to become that person's shadow and to mirror the dominant person's beliefs and ethics. They each receive justification from the other.
Huh.
So murder almost becomes this bonding element between them. I think that plays out in the Billy-Stu relation. I think you see that very clearly, that Stu is the subservient, and that I think Billy gets off on being the dominant one, and that he's in control of Stu. I think that's a big part of what's going on, and that Stu, he's weak and probably in not a good place emotionally, and Billy gives him the validation that he's searching for.
Yeah, and wouldn't Stu also give Billy some validation too?
Yeah, that's what this article says, that the dominant person feels validated by the loyalty of the subservient person.
Yeah, that's interesting, because when we think of a leader or we think of the dominant person, we automatically think that, oh, they're so confident and they're so dominant that they have full confidence in themselves that they don't need anyone else. But in reality, they kind of do. So I wasn't really expecting that. But now that you brought that up, it tells us that Billy needed Stu as well, just as much as Stu needed Billy. And that's interesting, because I'm not the leader type, right? Like, if I were in that type of relationship, I'd probably be the follower type just because of my personality. I'm very loyal. I'm more of a follower and a doer. And so that just surprises me that the dominant one or the leader would also need that type of support from the follower.
Yeah. And this is kind of how I got into approaching empathy with Stu. Again, like, nothing can justify the terrible things that Stu did, but it does kind of seem like that Billy preyed upon him, recognized him as someone weak that he could control, and took advantage of that when Stu really had no reason to be involved in this stuff. I think the motivation for Stu is that he's getting something out of this relationship with Billy, primarily. Some kind of, like, he's feeling validated, he's feeling powerful when he's probably felt weak all of his life, and now he's in control of something.
He's like the goofy, weak friend.
Yeah, and I can understand that feeling for sure.
Yeah.
I would never go about murder because of it, but the feeling, I think, is very relatable.
Yeah.
That, like, needing validation and wanting to have some sort of power and control over the things around me.
Yeah, I would rather, if you're going to get peer pressured, I'd rather you get peer pressured into doing lots of drugs, getting shwasted, wrecking things, than being peer pressured to murder.
Yeah. And you know what? Peer pressure doesn't always have to be bad. You can peer pressure people to do good things. Like, you can peer pressure people to, yeah, drink water, to be nice to each other. That's the kind of peer pressure I would like. To vote.
To vote. Okay. Okay, Honorable Citizen Joe. Good idea. Most people are probably being peer pressured to isolate someone or to do naughty things in the club. I don't know. But yeah, as long as they're not being peer pressured to murder, I'm okay. That's the line.
Stabbing is fine. Torture.
Good.
It's all right.
Want to make it Guantanamo Bay in here? Fine. Speaking of peer pressure, since Stu's motivation, you know, when he says that the reason why he's doing it is because of peer pressure, it seems pretty dumb. Like, it's not very solid motivation. It's a little bit stupid. It made me laugh a lot. And I thought it was great comic relief, which is strange to say, but it was. I have a question for you, and I'm really going to put a disclaimer on this. You know, like we said, so many disclaimers in this episode. No one here supports killing anyone, okay? Okay, now that we've established this, if you were a murderer, if you were a killer, if we know you're not, unless you want to admit, but nope, we know you're not.
I wouldn't admit it here. But I'm not.
Okay. Phew, it'd be really awkward if you did. If you were a murderer, what is a dumb motive of yours that you might use if you were a killer? But something dumb, like not very serious, you know, it's not like it's revenge or it's not like something traumatic happened in your life. It's just something dumb, really dumb.
Yeah, here's one. So I've got a compost bucket next to my sink.
Cool.
And I always put dry stuff into the bottom of the compost bucket first before I put wet, gooey stuff in there. And the reason is so that when I dump out the compost, it all comes out and there isn't gooey, slimy gunk on the bottom of the bucket. So I get so angry when other people come into my house and they just throw their gross, slimy food into the bottom of the clean compost bucket. It makes me viscerally angry in a way that is, like, difficult to describe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good to know. I'm really glad that I know that so that I don't do that if I am ever found in your house. Because, like I said in the beginning, I'm outside your house. I might come in. So I'm really glad I know that.
Yeah, I hate when people put cutting boards in the drying rack next to the sink.
Why?
Because they are very large and awkwardly shaped, and they go on the cutting board drying rack.
There's a cutting board dry rack? You have a separate dry rack for cutting boards?
Well, it's just the rack where I hold the cutting boards. But when you put the wet cutting boards onto the pile of plates and stuff, they don't stack well anymore. It prevents everything from drying.
Well, then how? Maybe you should just get a better cut cutting board.
It's hard to explain.
Okay.
I'm finding out right now that I have OCD.
Okay. You're diagnosed.
Yeah. But no, like, yeah, there's a lot of little things like that where I'm like, this is how you're supposed to do things. And yeah. I just like, oh, I'll like freak out if they're not done that way. But then I'm like, all right, this is dumb.
I think a good lesson is to just tell people this so that you don't imagine strangling them. Just kidding. I know you wouldn't. But yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that, actually.
Yeah, I've never actually considered murder. Right. But I have bottled it up all inside and then cried about it.
Yeah.
After like a month.
Cry? Like cry? Like.
Yeah.
Oh.
Not specifically about like this one thing. I'm just saying like I bottle up all the little things.
Right.
And then let it out in one go, like every couple of months. Anyways, what would you murder for?
A few things. I have this like really intense fear of people being mad at me. And like if someone was mad at me, like even like 5 years ago, I still remember it very vividly. And that's not to say that you can't be mad at me. Like I'm an adult, like people should be able to be mad at me, but it still like gets to me. So I feel like if someone came up to me and they were like, you have to kill that person or I'm going to be mad at you, then I would be like, okay. Not thinking about how the person I killed, how their family would be mad at me, but just that one single person, they're like, I'm going to be so mad and I'm going to send a really long text message about how mad I am at you if you don't kill someone. Like, that could be one of my dumb motives. The other thing is, like, I don't really like it when I'm like at Walmart or at the grocery store and I'm walking through the aisle and maybe I'm like in the candy aisle and there's a random wrench from the hardware section in the candy aisle just sitting on a shelf on top of a Hershey bar or something. Because someone decided that they didn't want to buy that object anymore, so they just placed it wherever they were in the grocery store instead of putting it back in its place. And I'm like, all you had to do was just walk it back, get some more steps in. And so I feel like I would be like, ha ha, I found you, I saw you put that wrench there.
And then you'd beat them with the wrench.
Oh, no. Anywho, the kicker, though, is that I have totally done that before. Like, I have done the thing that I hate. I have totally, like, been like, oh, I don't want this thing anymore, but I don't remember where I got it from. I don't.
I'm with you on that because I have all these rules, but for some reason, every now and then I will break the rule. Yeah. And it's fine.
Right. I love myself.
But God forbid someone else break it.
Right. Yeah. So those are my answers. On the record, I'm not killing anyone.
I have a slightly more serious question. I guess a deeper question. That was a question more geared towards Stu. I've got a Billy question.
Okay.
Because Billy murdered Sydney's mom, and then about a year passed where he started dating Sydney, and he probably was harboring this resentment all that time, and he like indulging it and letting it fester and grow inside of him. And maybe that's, I'm just talking myself into a new point here. Like, maybe that's why he goes on this killing spree,
yeah,
in the Scream movies. But I'm wondering, because I think this is probably relatable. Is there ever something where you've had this like little resentment that you've let grow and fester over time until it became something much bigger than it probably needed to be?
Yeah, for sure. And before I answer, that is really interesting that maybe it's that resentment that keeps growing that fuels him to keep killing even a year later, because it proves that killing the person that you hate or killing the person that caused that resentment in you, it doesn't make the resentment go away.
It indulges it.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it didn't go away. Like, enacting quote-unquote revenge or whatever that he felt he was enacting didn't help.
That's a really good point, because like, I love sugar and candy, and whenever I have any, I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna eat it all, then that'll solve it and I can move on. I'll have eaten all the candy and then like it'll be over. But really, I eat all the candy and then I just want more candy.
Yeah.
And it's never like resolved.
Yeah.
I've just like given myself more of a taste,
yeah,
for it and a stronger desire. Anyways.
Yeah, that's a lot friendlier of an example than Billy's. So yeah. I appreciate that.
He's given himself the taste of bloody murder.
Yeah. So we all know that like working in customer service can be very difficult, mm-hmm, because you deal with a lot of a-holes, you deal with being yelled at a lot. One of the many times that I've had an issue with like a hotel guest when I worked at a hotel, there was a guest who complained that his television wasn't working and he was drunk. I went to his room and it was honestly a very quick fix. I had seen that issue before, and so I just kind of fixed it. And he went on a full-blown rant about how he knew the owner of the hotel. And this was inside of his hotel room, so I was kind of in a vulnerable spot. Mm. And he was like, this is not how we built this hotel. And I remember working with him on building this hotel, and this is not how we did it. And then he threw the remote at me. And then I left, and then I was so beaten down that I actually comped his room, which...
What does that mean?
Oh, he paid $0 for his room. Like, I gave him a huge discount because I felt really threatened. I was a bit younger, so if it was now, I would have been like, oh, hell no. But at that time, I was scared that he was going to come back and yell at me if I didn't do something more to help him out. So I literally gave... He didn't have to pay a dime for his hotel room. And I shouldn't have rewarded that.
It sounds like you didn't let him fester. You just gave him.
I just gave in. like my resentment towards him has festered, and that was 6 years ago now.
Yeah. And if you ever saw him, you'd probably murder him.
Yeah. I mean, no. On the record, no. I wouldn't, but I just hope that he realizes he can't treat people like shit. And I didn't give him a very good lesson because I gave him $0 on his room.
Yeah.
But like, I think about it a lot. I'll think about it at night. I'll get really riled up. I'll like clench my fist and my jaw sometimes. And sometimes I get mad at myself, and maybe that's where some of the resentment comes, because I didn't hold my ground. Because I didn't make him pay for his room, because I didn't leave the hotel room when he started yelling. I should have just left. I wasn't paid enough to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he felt guilty later. At least that's what I like. That's what I imagine sometimes.
Yeah.
But I doubt it.
This is something I actually think a lot about. I deal with it at work a lot, where I have these little interactions with people that didn't go the way that I wanted them to go. Or, you know, like you said earlier, I also hate when people are mad at me. So like if someone at work is mad at me, then I will sit in my bed at night and just think about it, and like think about all the different things that I could have said to that person to change the situation, or like what I can say to them the next day to make the situation better. And what I'm learning is just that indulging these thoughts and thinking about it just increases them. And the real solution is just to kind of let them go, but it's hard.
Yeah, like how do you let it go?
Yeah, it feels so good to indulge in them. There's like this little like kick of adrenaline
you
get from it. But letting go kind of hurts, but like long term it's better. More specifically, where I've succeeded in this is like I've talked about how I get scared very easily, and I used to indulge that fear a lot and think about all the terrible things that could go wrong. For example, I used to check behind the shower curtain every single time I went into a bathroom.
Wow.
Because I was scared someone would be hiding there. And then one day when I first got, like a couple years ago, when I first started living alone, I decided to stop doing that. And then I just forgot about it. And now I rarely think about it anymore. And I realize that the fact that I was indulging that fear, like the fact that I was going to check every day, just made the fear like slowly grow inside of me. And the real solution, what solved it, was just stopping, just not indulging it and letting it grow. And it's really, really hard to do. But you really do wish that Billy could have learned that lesson, because it seems like he let this thing grow. And instead of just moving on, or trying to move on, he started dating the daughter of the woman that he believes ruined his life. And so it was a constant reminder for him. And it just probably grew and grew and grew, that resentment. And then it blistered out into this murder spree.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm still trying to figure out to this day how to effectively let go of things. Like, is it talking about it? Is it just mindfulness? I don't know.
It's hard. It's so hard, because the solution is to not do anything.
Huh.
Right? Because like the problem is thinking about it. Like the more you think about it, the more it's like in your mind. But how do you not think about it?
Huh.
It's like, how do you do nothing?
Yeah.
In a world, particularly in the US, which is capitalism driven, where like the entire mindset is that we must do things to produce. Like it's so hard to get into a different mindset altogether, where doing nothing is a thing. But it's not a thing, because doing a thing is a capitalist idea.
Right.
Ugh. How did we get here?
I don't know. Special thanks to Billy and Stu, mass murderers. We're talking about our feelings.
Yeah. Well, I've been on my soapbox enough tonight. do you have any other thoughts you'd like to add?
Nope.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. You can rate and review us on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on the social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. Just search for Next Door Villain or Next Door Villain Podcast. You'll find us. Our email is nextdoorvillain@gmail.com. We love hearing from you. And we're not just saying that. We both, I think, thrive on validation.
That's true.
So validate us, please.
Please. Or else I'll be outside your house. like I'm outside of Joe's. All right, peace.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for listening. I'm outside your house.